We continue now with Tales of the Holy Baal Shem Tov. The name of today's story is The Favor That Was Finally Returned. The situation for Rab Simcha and his family could hardly have been worse. Rab Simcha didn't have 2 groschen to rub together. His wife and children, together with him, were at the threshold of starvation, Rachman Litzlan, and he had no means of supporting himself nor his extended family. He had but one faint glimmer of hope, one idea, and since he was desperate, he decided that, as luckless as the idea may sound, he might as well try and see whether this would be a gateway to his and his family's physical salvation. Reb Simcha approached the local landowner one day and said to him, "You know that abandoned house at the edge of the forest which is on your estate?" Well, of course, this landowner knew about it. This shack had been without anybody within it for over 10 years. And whatever this Jew was willing to pay, surely would be profitable for him. And besides that, if the house was inhabited, the entire property would become worth more. And so he listened carefully to Rab Simcha's proposition. And Rab Simcha said to the landowner, "You know, I'd like to try my luck at innkeeping, but I have no money of my own to invest. But I think it would be a win-win situation that if you were to advance me some money to buy some whiskey and some food, and I'll be able to sell it at a tidy profit. And as soon as my first profits come in, I will begin to repay the loan and pay the rent." The landowner readily agreed, and Rab Simcha found himself in the new role of innkeeper. But since the tavern, the inn, was at the edge of the forest and it was not so readily accessible, business was very, very slow, and Rab Simcha and his family barely eked out a livelihood from the inn. Rab Simcha was not only a pious individual, but he was also a fervent chassid of the Baal Shem Tov. You can imagine his delight when one day the Baal Shem Tov himself paid Rab Simcha a visit in his humble inn. This was truly a joyous occasion for Rab Simcha, although for the life of him, he couldn't figure out what he could possibly serve that would be good enough for the Baal Shem Tov. But nevertheless, he put together at best as he could, and he prepared a suda for the Baal Shem Tov. "Before I sit down to eat this meal," the Baal Shem Tov said to Rab Simcha, "please do me a favor. My pushka of tabak, my little box in which I keep my snuff, was lost in the forest just before coming here. Could you take my horse and look around and see whether you could find it? It's very important for me. And if you would do it, I really would consider it a big favor." Of course, Rab Simcha was overjoyed to be able to be mishamish the Baal Shem Tov, to attend the Baal Shem Tov in yet another way. And he immediately set forth into the forest. Although it was getting dark, and he set forth with a candle to search for the pushka of shmek tabak, to search for the snuff box. Rab Simcha entered the forest and followed the road, looking right and left, carefully seeking under bushes, behind trees. Maybe it was lost here, and maybe it was lost there. And doing his best to find it, because he knew that if the Baal Shem Tov said this was important for him, he wanted to do his utmost to please the Baal Shem Tov and return with the found snuffbox. All of a sudden, while he was searching, Rab Simcha heard faint cries for help. Following the sounds, he rushed to the source of these cries and found a carriage half sunk in the mud of a riverbed, with its occupant trapped within the carriage. Rab Simcha, on his part, quickly tied his horse to the coach and, tugging and pulling to their last ounce of strength, Rab Simcha and Lahavdil, his horse, succeeded in releasing the coach and freeing its soaked occupant from what would have been a sure death. As soon as Rab Simcha saw the man he had freed, he said to him, "You are in a very, very bad condition," because the man was soaked to his skin from the freezing water. "If you don't get some attention right now, you can catch pneumonia. Come with me quickly to my house, where you can warm up, get some dry clothes, and eat a warm meal and say a l'chaim, take a drink, and you will warm up." Rab Simcha didn't even wait for an answer, but quickly took the man who he had rescued back home with him. When the Baal Shem Tov saw Rab Simcha enter with this individual, the Baal Shem Tov seemed to have completely forgotten about his supposed snuffbox. Rather, he said to Rab Simcha, "Here, put the man by the fire and give him the meal you have prepared in my honor. It's clear that this man is starving, that he was in the water a long time, and needs immediate care and attention." And so it was that all the members of Rab Simcha's household bustled and scurried about, seeking to make the man as comfortable and as warm as possible. And after a warm meal, and with a few shots of l'chaim, Rab Simcha took his bedraggled guest to a clean, warm bed, where the guest fell into a tired and unbroken sleep. Came the morning, and to the astonishment of Rab Simcha and his family, they found out that their rescued guest was none other than the prince of that entire country. The prince, on his part, was profuse in his thanks and effusive to Rab Simcha for rescuing him from a certain death, and said to him, "Please, let me reward you. Here are 2,000 rubles. You saved my life, and this is but a mere token of my appreciation." Rab Simcha looked longingly, very longingly, at the largest sum of money he had ever seen in his life, but slowly and somewhat sadly, but resolutely, shook his head. "No, thank you, Your Highness. I did my duty. Any man would have done the same. I can't take a reward for being a mensch, for being human. To take money for saving a life is beyond me." The prince looked around him, observing carefully the roof that leaked in quite a number of places, the doors that hung on single hinges, and the broken window panes that were stuffed with rags and covered with paper. In short, he saw the abject poverty of the inn. Then he looked at the children's tattered clothing and at their pinched and hungry faces, and again opened his purse. And he said to Rab Simcha, "You know, 2,000 rubles for what you did, that really wasn't enough. Here, take 10,000. I see that you need it. I can never really repay you for saving my life and for caring for me so very, very devotedly. You had no idea who I was, and you did it to a perfect stranger, And I understand that you are hesitant at taking money for doing a good deed. But please take this gift as a small token of appreciation and an expression of my thanks. Well, you can imagine, 10,000 rubles. Reb Simcha not only had never seen so much money in his life, he had never dreamed that so much money could have even existed. He looked at the Baal Shem Tov, who was seated at the table, but the holy Baal Shem shook his head, reaffirming his previous warning to Reb Simcha that he was under no circumstances to take any money from the prince. Reb Simcha, once again, somewhat sadly, but even more resolutely than before, declined the generous gift. The prince tried again and again, each time upping the ante, and finally he emptied out the entire contents of his embroidered purse. The gold coins shone on the table for a brief moment, and only for a brief moment, before the poor innkeeper gathered them quickly and returned them once and for all to the prince. Finally, admitting defeat, the prince turned to Reb Simcha and said to him, "Well, since you refuse to accept any money at all, any type of gift for what you have done, and I really feel that I owe you so much, let me at least write down your name in my records, so that I can forever recall the kindness you did for me." And no sooner said than done, Simcha's particulars, who he was, where he lived, the exact day of the deed, and all the details went into the prince's diary. Soon after the prince left, the Baal Shem Tov announced that it was time for him too to leave. And Reb Simcha, who scraped together the last few kopekes he had, gave it to the Baal Shem Tov as a pidyon nefesh, as for tzedakah. And the Baal Shem Tov wished Reb Simcha that his mazel should turn, that his fortune should turn for the better. After the Baal Shem Tov left, Reb Simcha's wife turned to him and said, "Did we really have to refuse all that money? It's not as if you didn't do anything. You saved the prince's life. You gave him a meal. You gave him lodging. He couldn't have found that any place. And here we are, literally starving. The last penny you gave to the Baal Shem Tov, we have nothing now. We're back where we started. What are we supposed to do? I really don't understand why the Baal Shem Tov insisted that you not take any money from the prince." Patiently, Rabbi Simcha explained to his wife that Nistoris Darkei Hashem, that God's ways are not always known and not always understood. But if the holy Baal Shem Tov, this holy man of God, had indicated to him so emphatically that he not take the money, surely the money was not his for the taking. As to his wife's question, what were they to do, Reb Simcha shrugged his shoulders and lifted up his eyes to heaven, indicating that it was in Hashem's hands, just as it was up until that point. And as Reb Simcha was fruitlessly trying to explain to his wife the strange turn of events, at that very moment, the sound of footsteps diverted their attention. A husky, burly farmer burst into the room and demanded a shot of whiskey. "There's nothing left in the barrel," whispered the woman to her husband. "We gave the last of it to the prince for him to warm up. We don't have anything at all." "Never mind," Reb Simcha whispered back. "Pour a bit of water to it. Maybe there's still enough at the bottom of the barrel to flavor this water with that which is remaining, and if it'll be a watered down drink, that's better than none at all, and maybe he'll be satisfied with that. And if he's not satisfied and he says it's too watery, well, we'll just have to give him his money back. But we have nothing what to lose." The woman hurried to place the little glass of most water and maybe tiny remnants of the whiskey from the barrel before the impatient Gentile peasant. The peasant, the farmer, downed it in one gulp, gave a deep sigh of satisfaction, and demanded more. Husband and wife looked at each other. But if that's what the man wanted, and so Reb Simcha's wife carefully and surreptitiously filled the barrel again with some water and placed yet a second glass on the table. Gulp, gulp, gulp followed the second glass down the man's throat as rapidly as did the first. "That's great liquor you've got," said the farmer. "I must tell my friends about this place. No place have I ever had such good liquor as this place." And the peasant clinked some coins on the table. Once again, husband and wife looked at each other in utter consternation. For the life of them, they couldn't figure out what it was that the peasant farmer had tasted from their empty liquor barrel. It seemed, however, that this was the turning point in Reb Simcha's fortunes, and his mazel began to smile on him. The fame of Reb Simcha's liquor spread among the local Gentiles, who began frequenting the little tavern regularly. As for Reb Simcha, it didn't take much investment to produce liquor, because, after all, if all you had to do was add water, then he had it made. For Reb Simcha's whiskey barrel was blessed. It was never empty. It always produced the same strong mashke, the same strong spirits, on demand. People began streaming there, asking for a glass and another glass, one shot and another shot, and the fame of Reb Simcha's liquor was beginning to spread far and wide. And come the late evening, after the people would leave, Reb Simcha and his wife would fill up the barrel again with water, and those who would come the next day would rave about this wonderful, strong, and delicious liquor. And things were really looking up. The family was soon able to afford decent furniture to accommodate their growing clientele with overnight service. The roof was fixed. The windows were painted. The children now went dressed properly, had shoes, had food. Reb Simcha was even able to buy the property from its owner and feel himself to be a prosperous man in his own inn. But things did not run smoothly for too long. One day, two Gentiles checked into the inn and requested a night's lodging. They had downed a considerable amount of liquor with their meal, and having eaten well and drunk even more well, they retired to their room. In the middle of the night, a violent scuffling was heard, accompanied by shouts. And then one of the room's occupants rushed outside and awakened all the other guests in the inn. My friend, he's been murdered," he shouted. "The landlord stole his money and murdered him, thinking he could get away with it by blaming it on me. But I know the truth. I know that that Jew did it. Get the police. Call them quickly. Help! Before he kills me as well." The police were quickly summoned and had to take Reb Simcha for questioning. Now, since there was no witness to the crime besides the roommate who accused Reb Simcha of the murder, and the dead man's money was in fact missing, the police were inclined to believe this false and malicious testimony. And poor Reb Simcha was brought to trial, found guilty, and sentenced to hang. As Reb Simcha lay on the straw mattress in his dank and dingy prison cell, he thought darkly to himself, "This is the lot of the Jew. It's his word against the Gentile, and he's got no chance whatsoever. Look what happens. Things were finally looking up, and here I am, sentenced to hang." But then he thought to himself, "No, that's not true. I know I'm innocent, and since I am innocent, surely Hashem is on my side, and He will surely save a blameless man from an ignominious death." And so Reb Simcha sat up on his bed and began reciting Tehillim by heart, once again filled with hope and betochen and faith in Hashem that the Almighty would deliver him from this terrible predicament. In the midst of being immersed in Tehillim, Reb Simcha suddenly heard the sound of a rusty key turning the lock of his cell door. A government officer walked in and, to Reb Simcha's utter amazement, announced to him, "You are a free man. The king has granted you full amnesty." But what had happened? How was he free? How could this be? The law of that country required that all death sentences be reviewed by the king. When Reb Simcha's case had been brought before him, the king, who I think you figured out, happened to be the very prince saved so many years ago by our own Reb Simcha, recalled the name. Reb Simcha, that's a familiar name. And he looked in his book. And yes, that's the Jew from that location. Seeing that it was indeed the same individual, and reminding himself of how Reb Simcha refused not only 2,000 rubles, but even 10,000 rubles, the king exclaimed to himself, "What? This man is alleged to have committed the murder in order to steal the dead man's money? That's incredible! That's impossible! That's a total fabrication, a lie of the first order, of the greatest magnitude. When I was by him and tried to reward him with a princely sum of money for saving my life and getting him out of extreme and dire poverty, this man absolutely refused to accept it. it cannot be that now this man who, as I see in the testimony, is a man of means, a man of considerable worth and wealth on his own right, could have committed a crime for material gain. No! A person who refuses 10,000 ruble outright when he is so poor is not going to kill somebody for a paltry few ruble. Something is very, very wrong here. And so the king demanded that the witness be cross-examined again and much more closely. Surely, said the king, he may have a different story to tell the police after they use a bit of gentle persuasion on him. And so it was. The police really did not find it too hard to get to the bottom of the matter and to extract the truth from that so-called witness, who, as it turned out, and could have been easily found out if they would have cared in the first place, that he himself, the other Gentile, was the murderer who had tried to pin the crime on the poor, hapless Reb Simcha. And so, that fellow, the true murderer, was duly executed, while Reb Simcha was rewarded by the king with title to an estate, as well as the money that he had once refused to take. And ever since then, Reb Simcha lived a well-deserved life of ease and comfort. And as to Reb Simcha's wife, she finally understood why the Baal Shem Tov insisted that the money not be taken. It would finally come to them at the right time and in the right circumstances, with much more than money at stake.